this product strategy idea at Pickle, was let's eliminate customization so we can pass on much lower costs to our customers, and let's focus on retrofit opportunities in buildings that are already totally operational.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. We're glad that you're here, and thank you for subscribing. My name is Jim Beretta, and I'm happy to have AJ from Pickle Robot on this edition of A3, the Robot Industry Podcast. AJ, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Hey, can you tell our audience a little bit about you and how you got started in this industry?
Sure. So I guess it goes back to my undergrad days. I went to MIT a million years ago. And in the early 2000s, I was really fascinated by how machine learning might interact with controlling robots. And we did some projects in object recognition and some walking robots and some flying robots, but it was all very nascent space. And I didn't see any immediate commercial applicability in 2008. So we put a pin in it. We started another company. That company went on to be an R&D firm called Leaf Labs that basically does science projects for FANG. So we've worked with all of the major tech companies on some of their most advanced and highest risk programs. And after a decade of that, we started to get a sense that, you know, there's like billions of dollars being invested in autonomous driving tech right now. I wonder if we can harvest any of that tech to go back to robotics, right? Back to my roots. And I think the key problem has been for robotics startups to get really excited about a particular algorithm or piece of technology or somebody's PhD thesis. We didn't want to do that. So we spent about 6 months or so just exploring different customers, different markets, what different problems might be. And we eventually wound up taking a tour of a parcel processing plant where they sort packages. And we watched people spend hours at night unloading these trucks. Like there's no HVAC in these trucks. In the wintertime, it's in the negative. In the summertime in California, it can be 130 degrees in the trailers. And you just have to move the material. It's really backbreaking. And man, we just stood and watched that and thought, you know, I think that with 2020 technology, this is solvable in a way that it was not with a robotic solution in 2010. And that was the genesis of the company.
And so the problem you're solving is what?
Oh, yeah, sure. The problem we're solving is we're trying to load and unload trucks with robot arms. Frankly, if we can figure out how to load and unload them without robot arms, we would do that too. But really, we're trying to amplify a person's ability to move that material through the loading dock. So let's say right now a person can unload, I don't know, 1,000 cases an hour from the back of a truck. And, you know, mind you, there's like almost 20 billion packages get delivered in the United States this year. So, you know, it's a lot of material going in and out of the backs of trucks. So a person can do 1,000. Is there some way that we can have a person do 5,000? And what would that look like? And so the solution that we've come up with is to take a robot arm and mount it on a mobile base, and it drives into the truck, and it uses a vacuum-type gripper, and it picks up packages and puts them on a conveyor belt and gets them out of that truck at you know, a little faster than 1,000 pieces an hour. Now, the trick is to realize that because we've pretty much cribbed all the tech from self-driving, it doesn't work all the way, right? The robot has an issue every few minutes where, you know, it drops something on the floor, it doesn't know how to pick up a car tire, the shape of the thing is weird, or it doesn't hold vacuum. And so we've imagined that there's going to still be a person, but that one person might oversee five robots. So now you've gone from 1,000 picks an hour for a person to 5,000 an hour for that same person. And we hope it's a much more interesting job as well. Leave the hard backbreaking part to the robot and the kind of problem solving finicky parts to people, which they're best at.
And that's a really cool idea. And let's talk about the challenges of unloading trucks from a human perspective. You've already said this is really hard, terrible work.
Yeah, well, where do we start? So the first concern is just the repetitive stress injury aspect to it. And they take this more seriously in Europe than they do in the United States. But just because the regulations change doesn't mean that the worker experience is any different. If you've got 4 hours in a stretch where you're just picking up a 50-pound box, turning 90 degrees, and putting it down on a conveyor belt. I've done this job very briefly, and I'm thankful that I don't have to do it any more than I already have. One of the funniest things about this business is when people find out that we build robots that unload trucks. So many industry professionals, they might be engineers or executives. I've met people in marketing, and they say, "Oh, you know, when I was this in this age at a different time in my life, I did that job." And it's a really, really hard job. Another problem is just the conditions in the trailer are really extreme. They don't put air conditioning or heating systems back there. And so it's not at all atypical to walk into a trailer and you open the door and it's 130 degrees Fahrenheit back there because they've been driving around the desert to get to the warehouse. So it's a very hostile environment.
Let's talk a little bit about the loading dock, because I've never had that job. And so What all happens at the loading dock? Certainly the packages are coming in. What are some of the other things that are happening there?
Sure. Well, you know, the interesting thing about the loading dock is that it's a part of the operation that almost everybody has, right? So whether you're in manufacturing or you're sorting packages or you're fulfilling orders, you're like an e-commerce warehouse or some kind of 3PL, everybody's got trucks pulling up to the loading docks that need to get material taken in and out. So the types of things that you see there, first of all, it's worth disambiguating between two types of loads. You have pallet loads, which they don't use the space in the back of the truck very effectively. It's like maybe you only get 60% utilization of the volume of the trailer. But they're really easy to move in and out of the truck. So just imagine a pallet. It's got a bunch of stuff on it. Doesn't matter what the stuff is. It's usually wrapped in cellophane. And then somebody can forklift all that material out of the in or out of the trailer and then stage it in the loading dock. So one thing you're always going to see lots of around loading docks is like staged pallets. Another type of load is called a loose load. Sometimes it's called a floor load or a fluid load. You know, various different flavors of the word because there's so many different segments of the industry that has a similar looking situation. They give it a different word. But basically what we mean is just boxes stacked up on the floor. And sometimes they're all the same box, and sometimes there's two or three different kinds of boxes, or sometimes, if you go to a FedEx or a UPS, something in the parcel industry, it's just every type of object you can imagine. You know, little boxes, big boxes, small boxes, canvas bags, plastic bags, car tires, fire extinguishers, right? So, and maybe one way to think about it is as you move from a manufacturing context to a last mile delivery context. So the item is getting made and then eventually you order it on the internet and then it arrives at your house at some point. As you move down the supply chain, the trailers get messier and messier. And it's pretty easy to understand why that would be because when the stuff comes out of the factory, it's 5,000 boxes of all the same object. And then as they go through layers of distributors and ultimately to the final shipper, you're mixing all different kinds of objects because I could be buying anything from my house from all different distributors. So what else happens at the loading docks? You're moving pallets around. You're moving boxes and other material into and out of trucks. Kind of the final variation that we see across customers is whether or not they hook the trucks directly up to their conveyor belt network. So really automated buildings or large operations have many tens of millions of dollars in some cases, sometimes more than that, of conveyance and sortation equipment and other automation. And sometimes they jack this stuff directly into the back of the truck. So what you'll see, whether it's an unload or a load, is a conveyor belt that goes all the way inside the truck. And then you have an employee whose job it is to either pick boxes off the conveyor and stack them in the back of the truck or pick boxes from the back of the truck and put them on the conveyor belt. And then the conveyor belt will then whisk the package away into some automated sortation equipment or something like that. So those are it's kind of like the environment that we come into. And we looked at that environment and decided that the best product that we could ship into this environment that would solve the biggest problem for the most number of people was a robot that would unload the loose loaded trailers directly onto a conveyor belt.
Nice. And then from an automated perspective, is there anything that's happening in the loading dock? Like you mentioned, conveyors. Is there scanning or weighing or cameras or what's happening?
Yeah, there's everything. I mean, it depends on the customer. But sometimes you see six-sided scanning tunnels that will look at all the labels, find which side the label is on, dimension the package. Sometimes you see scales, so we can measure the weight of the package as it goes in or out. You see a lot of equipment related to dealing with different types of exceptions. And these can be really simple. I'll give you an example. Let's say that I'm trying to take a package from a truck into a conveyor belt and then onto what's called a tilt tray sorter, which is a big racetrack. I mean, we're talking potentially thousands of feet long in some cases. And every section of the racetrack has a little 1 foot or a 2 foot little, it's a tray.
Like a chute?
Yeah, a little, and you put the box on the tray, or the conveyor belt dumps the box on the tray, and then the tray gets synchronized with a bunch of other bins on the floor, and it dumps them into the bins on the floor. So this is how you sort packages, or one of the many ways to sort packages. And those trays are really finicky. There's a lot of moving parts. So if you get the box kind of, it's the wrong size, or it's not aligned on the belt well, or it's turned around the wrong way, or the label's not facing, there could be a zillion different reasons why the interface between this this belt and this tilt tray system is going to fail. And so upstream of that, you're going to catch those, they're called exceptions, and bump them off. So a typical conveyor automation system looks like a series of checks to try and filter out all of the things that are going to break it, so that by the time you get to the work, which is sorting the package or whatever, it's not going to break. Very expensive. Hopefully what I'm describing sounds very expensive.
So this is a big business. How do you segment your customers?
Great question. So it's a really complicated market, and I don't know that this will be our forever segmentation, but I feel like we've done a pretty good job of simplifying the map. And here's how we think about it. Imagine a quadrant diagram, like a big plus. And so on one axis, you're going to say, I'm interested in parcel sortation, delivery packages coming to your house, or I'm interested in fulfillment, like orders being packed and shipping out from a distributor or an Amazon or something like that. And then on the other axis, on the y-axis, we're going to say there's enterprise customers, big multi-billion dollar, UPS, Amazon, this kind of thing. And then on the other axis, we're going to have everybody else, mid-market customers, $1 billion in revenue or less. And less goes way down. I mean, you have customers that are doing very useful work in e-commerce, but they only have 200,000 square feet and one warehouse and 50 employees and perfectly viable business that pack orders and sort packages. So those are the four quadrants, enterprise parcel, imagine UPS, FedEx, DHL. Mid-market parcel, which would be like a laser ship or an on-track, maybe Pitney Bowes a little bit is kind of on the line. Then enterprise fulfillment, it's like your Walmart, Amazon, maybe XPO, like a really big 3PL. And then mid-market fulfillment, which is where all of our first customers have been so far. You'd be surprised when you order something online, the scope of different companies that collaborate to get that order to your door. You have this imagination that's like you hit a button and Amazon just figures it all out. And they are very vertically integrated. But there's plenty of packages on Amazon Prime that are being fulfilled from third-party buildings and little startup companies and mom-and-pop 3PLs and large 3PLs. It really takes a village to do this whole next-day delivery thing.
And you're pretty focused on your offering, you're unloading trucks, not loading trucks. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about this and why you're so focused?
Yeah, great question. Long term, we'd like to do both. And not only do we want to load and unload trucks, we also want to load the last mile vehicles, like the delivery sprinter vans and the package cars that come to your house, UPS Big Brown, those cool custom trucks. And also, there's air freight containers we'd like to load and unload. Sometimes people call them igloos because they're shaped like the bottom of the airplane. So we want to load and unload everything. Well, we started with unload. Why is that? Number one, it's the easiest. It's only slightly harder than picking up packages from a pile. And you can just imagine. And the reason it's harder is because I can't pick up any package that I can see. If I do that, the whole wall will fall down on me. So I have to pick them in a certain order. So it was a natural next step. When we were doing our technical roadmap, we started by picking up packages off a conveyor belt. And then we learned to pick them up off a pile. And then now that we can pick them from a pile, now we're unloading them from a wall, you know, a stack of packages in the trailer. So the technical roadmap had to advance in a reasonable way so that we could put one foot in front of the other and not spend 5 years in R&D trying to figure out loading. The next interesting lens through which to view this, hopefully most of your listeners are familiar with the word entropy, right? There's a lot more ways to unload a truck than there are to load it. I remember having an investor once ask me, I don't understand, like the demo for unload is coming along. Why can't you start taking on load projects? It's just the same thing in reverse. And you know, the immediate thought that popped into my head was, if you can figure out how to take the heat in your house and turn it back into natural gas, you know, that's kind of the same physics that's happening when you're loading versus unloading a truck. But you'll see in a couple of years, we'll be loading them as well.
And AJ, you're positioning your solutions as a product.
Yeah. So what does that mean to have a product approach to the market versus a project approach? I mean, most of automation is project solutions. Mm-hmm. You go visit a customer. They have a very complicated series of processes that have been working for them. Or maybe they're designing a new building from scratch and it has to do, 10,000 things in order to be a viable plant. And you work with that customer sometimes over multiple years to design a series of solutions that are going to link together. You know, they call that system integration to solve whatever the problem is. You know, sort packages more quickly, fill more orders more quickly, reduce the square footage of the plant, increase the throughput of the plant. You know, there's all these different goals that customers would chase. And most of the cost of those types of engagements goes to the customization and the architecture and the integration. It's not the equipment. The equipment's like 20% of the cost. So what we realized was two things. Number one, we could deploy stuff way cheaper if we got rid of a lot of that customization so that the cost really was the equipment as opposed to a bunch of customization. And the way that we were going to eliminate customization was by focusing not on doing every task in the warehouse, but by doing one task in every warehouse, right? And that task seems to be loading and unloading trailer. I mean, every warehouse has got dock doors. And so because it's so, standardized, the thought was that we could usefully solve a problem for people with very little customization and keep costs low. The other insight that we had was that most automation is not serving old buildings, in the brownfield they call it. There's greenfield, new projects, there's brownfield, old buildings. And there are loads of logistics infrastructure, warehouses that have been functioning for decades without much modification. And the reason is that if you want to start doing a little automation, it quickly ends up being a lot of automation with belts and lots of integration and sensors and a WES system and software upgrades and all this stuff. You end up just like saying, let's focus our capital expenditures on new buildings and leave the old ones as they are and not do too much with retrofit projects. So if your market is only new buildings, it's not a very big market. How many buildings get built in a typical month? If we could design robots that would retrofit in a cost-effective way into existing operations, well, we could then sell to thousands of buildings instead of, just the one that happens to be under construction right now. So those were the two insights that drove this product strategy idea at Pickle. Was let's eliminate customization so we can pass on much lower costs to our customers, and let's focus on retrofit opportunities in buildings that are already totally operational. Now that's easy to say and very hard to do, but that's what we're doing.
And you talked a lot about cost, AJ. What is the cost people are looking at? I'm sure people are thinking about, oh my gosh, it sounds expensive.
Yeah, well, it can be, and it also can be cheaper than you expect. The least expensive systems that we spec for customers are about $3,500 a month. Everything that we do is on a lease model, and we maintain everything for that price, and we upgrade the software for that price, and we do all the customer service and telemetry and keep these things running. And then it costs an additional $30,000 as a setup fee to kind of cover the cost of us coming out to do the installation. and everything is month to month. That's the least expensive system that we do. The most expensive systems that we've spec'd out are closer to $60,000 for an implementation and more like $9,000 a month. And you can imagine at least some of the differences between the cheap and the expensive is things like payload, speed, the type of robot that we're working with, and also just the amount of hours that you're planning to put on the thing. So as a lease model, it's going to depreciate. You know, parts wear out. You know, motors need to be replaced. So if you're running it 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, you're going to end up paying more than if you're a 40-hour a week kind of operation.
One of the things that you're doing as a byproduct is you're going to be creating a lot of data. And I wanted to talk a little bit, have you talk a little bit about that and about the value of the data too.
Yeah, well, we've already been creating a lot of data. So I mean, one of the interesting things about Pickle, because some of the other robotics companies in this space have just spent enormous amounts of money trying to get started. I mean, in some cases, hundreds of millions of dollars. So we actually got past our 500,000th production pick at our fourth fully operational customer site before our Series A. You know, we were only like 10 people in the whole company putting robots out in the field and gathering all the data from the picks. So what do you do with that data? Well, the first thing you do with it is you give it to the customer. The customer really likes to see it. They want to know things like, did I pay too much for shipping? You know, the label says that this package weighs a pound, but I didn't really weigh it. I'm just going off of the SKU. But the robot can weigh it, right? And we can put that in a database somewhere the customer can look up. The customers also are trying to improve their own processes and numbers. And one of the greatest things about the loading dock, and part of how we chose it so strategically, is that it is either the input or it's the output to the entire operation. So if your goal is to improve the kind of operational flow of your building, you know, so instead of having spikes where you're going 1,000 packages an hour through your building and then that drops to 100 and then that goes up to 2,500 and then it goes down to 200, all that variation is expensive and it's hard to manage. So the way that you fix that is by starting either at the input or the output. If I can unload a trailer, you know, right on cue all day long at, let's call it 1,000 an hour, just every 5 seconds we're gonna do a package, or every 3.5 seconds we're gonna do a package. That's way better than bursting, right? And so that's the second thing customers want that data for. They want to see that real time. What is my throughput through this work cell, and what does that mean for how I need to manage the rest of my building to try and smooth out these peak and trough cycles? The third thing that we do with the data is we use it to improve the product. Greatly. I mean, I'll give you a good example. We were having trouble in production earlier this summer where if the robot picked directly onto a shipping label, particularly if that shipping label had just been printed and so the adhesive was still kind of warm, we'd peel the label off, which is a disaster, right? Now you've lost the package. You can't do that. And so we decided to create a slight new feature on the AI side of the product, so that we could understand, visually, we could understand shipping labels, where are they on the package, and try and tell the robot to make a slightly better decision about how to pick up that package so that it wasn't gonna peel the label off. And we were able to execute that in really just 2.5 weeks or so, from soup to nuts, because we have thousands of images coming in every day of packages that we can train off of, right? And we can even write new code for making different picking decisions and ship them to the field where only maybe 2% of the picks are going to run the new code and 98% of the picks run the old code. And so if you make a mistake on your new code, like, it doesn't bring anybody down. It's just the numbers go down a little bit. And if it works, you know, you expand it from 2% to 10% to all of them.
Why are your customers buying? Like, you must be having these conversations, and you must, I imagine, get a huge variety of reasons.
Yeah. I mean, first off, it's different in every market, and the only market that I'm intimately familiar with is the United States. And we've been careful to stay in our own backyard, so to speak, so that, because we're just so small, we can't sustain projects internationally. The labor crunch situation right now is very real. I think depending on if you look at a large enterprise customer, they're still more interested in throughput and operational you know, KPIs that they're trying to juice. Because think, if you're Walmart and you can push more packages through a building or more orders, you don't have to build as many buildings. Right. And the buildings are really expensive if you're Walmart, hundreds of millions of dollars in some cases. So pushing more material through the building is still more important to some customers. I don't know if Walmart would count them among this, but some customers, than the labor crunch situation. For other customers, the labor crunch is just insane. I was talking to a distributor recently who imports goods from overseas, and they unload 8 or 9 containers a day. They've been doing this for years very successfully. And they said that when they try and get 20 what are called lumpers, these are people who professionally unload trucks as a staff, like a staffing agency that, that specializes in unloading, to show up, 3 would show up. Not 8, not 10, not 5, 3 out of 20. And so you've designed your business around the assumption that you can put a certain number of packages, you know, through the loading dock in a given shift. And if you can't get anybody to show up for work, your whole business falls apart. So that's really scary for a lot of operators. The good news is that puts a lot of upward pressure on wages. And I mean, if you are looking for a part-time job that pays really well, right, you can walk into to any of these warehouses and try and do this. But I warn you, these are really hard jobs.
What's their ROI then? I mean, a lot of times, it's a pretty wide question. Is it measured now in probably months?
Yeah. So you asked me about cost a minute ago, and I gave you real numbers in like thousands of dollars. I think a much better way to think about cost is just in terms of ROI. That's how the customers think about it anyway. And so if you have a sophisticated, large customer looking to make some big investments on improving their business, think like an enterprise, a Walmart or a UPS, you know, they really want something that's going to pay for itself 3 years or faster. Maybe 2.5 years would be a really nice sales pitch for an enterprise customer. For a mid-market customer, they don't want to sit around on a 3-year investment. I mean, and they're taking a flyer on a startup company. It's already high risk enough. You really need to be able to argue that this thing's going to pay for itself in a year. Now, the good news is that there's a lot less customization and cost that goes into serving a mid-market customer than an enterprise. You can show up to a mid-market customer with a robot in a crate and set it up in an afternoon and turn it on. You spend a couple days training and you go home, and now you've substantially automated a process in their building. Very easy to get a sub 1-year payback when that's what it looks like. As soon as you engage with a big multi-billion dollar behemoth, there's just no way around custom software integrations, 3D modeling, a long sales cycle, etc. So we've really been focused on these middle market customers that can just execute so much more quickly than the big guys.
I would think too that there's a big benefit to getting trucks, like getting a third party's truck in and out of your facility on their side, right? On the third party truck side.
You're talking about the fees for when you get stuck with a trailer sitting on the dock door for too long.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. There's more ways than just labor that this costs you, right? So, you know, we've been talking about unload because that's the flagship activity for Pickle right now. But we do have a first product, which is a sortation product, and it picks up small packages, you know, less than 12, 13 pounds, depends on the customer, and sorts them. And we've been doing that for about a year in production now. And, if I missort a package and I put it, you know, I put it in the wrong bin, I just cost my customer like $5, maybe more, right? They slipped their SLA. A customer was expecting the package to arrive next day, and it's not going to because it went on the wrong truck. So that's a really big mistake. You can actually end up spending more money in sort defects than on the labor itself. So, and that's just one example. So you gave another good one. If the trailer can't get unloaded on time and it sits on your dock door, eventually you start racking up fees to have it sit there. If you are not using your building efficiently, some companies have what are called straight line sorters. So we talked about tilt trays as a type of that. They're really expensive. And so if you're keeping it 20% loaded, you know, your $20 million machine is just not being used. But it's still depreciating. You know, all the parts are still moving. The maintenance staff is still there keeping it running. So all these little bottlenecks, really create a lot of costs Not to mention just like the turnover. If somebody comes on the job, works for 3 days, and then disappears, you just blew thousands of dollars in onboarding fees and training and other things for a relationship that didn't work out. So you really want to reduce employee turnover, and we think that the best way to do that is, besides paying more, is by making the jobs more interesting. And so rather than have the person do the rote part where you turn off your brain and just use your muscles, let's switch that the other way around. Let's let the robot do the part where it turns off its brain and uses its muscles. And the person does all of the exception handling, which is surprisingly the exact opposite of how most of this stuff works today.
I'm a big believer of, if I'm looking for a job and I'm looking in warehousing or something, and I get a chance to work for a company that's mechanized, that has automation in it, or not, I will actually head more for the company that invests in automation. So I think it's a great example. You mentioned about the difference between kind of Europeans and North Americans purchasing automation. So why do Europeans purchase automation differently than North American companies?
Yeah, I feel a little underqualified to answer that just because, again, our focus area right now is in the United States. But from the customers that I've talked to in Europe, really top of mind for them is regulatory compliance. And so they have all kinds of really serious concerns about safety, about repetitive stress injuries, and they're willing to spend a lot of money to just try and reduce a person's exposure to physical risk. Now, they care about that stuff in the United States too. And if you tour, large plants, they take safety very, very seriously because it's just the most expensive problem. And honestly, I think there have been good role models there in the United States. Amazon is a great role model. They take safety incredibly seriously, which is maybe surprising given their reputation in the public. But anyway, so in Europe, they just have a big incentive because of the regulatory environment to reduce the likelihood that anyone can get hurt. And picking up heavy objects and moving them around all day, it's a really easy way to get hurt.
Which robot companies are you working with, or can you talk about that?
Sure. We use two robot platforms now. So we have two products, right? The package sorter and the unload. And the package sort robot is based on a UR platform. And we have a very nice close relationship with UR, and I assume that product is going to stay in the UR ecosystem, through its next generation. And UR has been an awesome partner. I think they're one of the few robotics companies that really understands that the key market for them is logistics. Right now, robot arms and in warehouses, it's an idea. It's an exciting idea. It has a lot of venture capital behind it. I have some of that venture capital, right? But it's still very early days. But if you fast forward 10 years, robot arms and logistics is going to overtake robot arms in automotive. And there's a lot of market research to back that up. UR gets it. And a lot of the other arm companies are struggling to understand that. And we can talk about what that actually means. But our other robot vendor is KUKA, who've also been super supportive, and we love working with them. We use the KR70 for the unload robot. It's got loads of payload. It's very fast. And we've just gotten great support from the engineers at KUKA. So those are the two vendors.
AJ, in our pre-call, we talked about the big project that you're working on, which sounds kind of exciting. Can you let our audience know a little bit about what that looks like?
Well, so let me tell you about unload, because it's certainly our biggest event right now. So we've been slowly building over the last few years towards unloading a trailer in production at rate, where rate is like 800 or 1,000 packages an hour over the course of an entire shift averaged out. So that is rapidly approaching. Q1 of 2022. We have our first production pilot lined up out in California. And then we have four more production pilots like every month after that. So by the summer of 2022, we think that we should be reliably unloading trailers for customers in multiple different production contexts. Now, as you improve the product quality, the size of your addressable market goes up. So some customers are perfectly happy to let you unload a truck at 600 pieces an hour. So you serve those customers first, but other customers, it needs to be 1,200 or it doesn't work for them. You're forced to modify their other processes too much. So as the robot gets faster, you can serve more customers. And so the treadmill that Pickle is putting itself on is to put one robot out in the world, use that production data to improve the metrics like speed and, you know, error rates. And then now with the improved metrics, you get to put more robots out in the world and so on and so forth until you are solving, you know, the 80% of the use cases and you have a really big business.
So I know that you're just getting started, but what's kind of next up for Pickle?
Yeah, I mean, so we're just totally focused right now on keeping the production systems we have thriving and getting the unload system out in market through its alpha pilots in Q1. You know, we're still more than a year away from kind of general production, you know, not alpha, not beta, just buy it and we ship it to you for unload. We have loads of customers that, I mean, hundreds of customers that have been calling us up and saying, you know, how do I get one of these unload robots sooner rather than later? You know, my CEO tells me that automating the loading dock is our number one automation priority. You know, how do I engage with Pickle? And the answer is two ways. You know, we have a deposit program right now where you can put your name down for a very reasonable $1,000 fee and engage with us to say, you know, robot number blah is going to go to this location. And we want to really deeply understand with our deposit customers, what is the use case in terms of payload, speed? Do they want the packages to be gapped on the conveyor? If so, what's the gapping? Is there needs to be left aligned on the conveyor? Is there any software integration that is mandatory? You know, ideally there's not, but some customers have. So let's work through the needs and get you on the schedule and make progress on your automation goals. The second way to engage with us as a Pioneer customer, and we have several already, is much more deep type of engagement. We're looking for customers that have credibly a 50 plus unit use case, and we're interested in trying to find one in each segment, which we already have. So we're probably, you know, looking for two in each segment. And we talked about the four segments, right? Enterprise parcel, mid-market parcel, fulfillment, and mid-market fulfillment. And so for those larger use cases, we're going to come on site and we're going to spend a lot of time gathering data about, you know, what do the trucks look like when they arrive in your building and what do the loads look like and how does this hook up for the rest of your automation and really take a more solutions-oriented approach just for those Pioneer customers while we boot up. And then hopefully we will have enough representation in that group that everybody else can reuse the effort that went into those relationships on a more product off the rack kind of basis.
AJ, thank you for this. It's been very informative. Did we forget anything?
Well, we are recruiting like crazy. So to the extent that you have industry professionals and engineers that are interested in coming to work at Pickle, I mean, truly every function in marketing and sales, operations, we've really interesting things going on in deployment operations where you get to travel all around the country and play with robots. Certainly in engineering, if you work in the self-driving car industry. All across the board. We're growing 10% a month every month for the next 2 years.
Nice. Well, that's exciting times.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And I think also that it's just the coolest industry. You know, like a few years ago, I was talking to a professor in a group of other students, and this person was involved in the AV industry, self-driving. And he says, if you're not working on self-driving and you're skilled in the art of AI and the relevant engineering areas, you know, you're doing your career wrong. This is the most exciting thing going. You know, and that rang true then, but now that we understand how hard 99.999% reliability really is in self-driving, you know, the place where that actually changes the world, and it will, by the way, right? But it keeps getting pushed out. Whereas the frontier of AI, it's right here in the loading dock. It's robot arms picking up packages in warehouses. And because we can make mistakes, you know, we don't need 99.99. Like 98% reliability is fine. 5 minutes of uninterrupted robot time is fine. That means that we're going to change the world right now. So if you're excited about robotics and artificial intelligence, the future of work, I think you should come visit us here in Boston.
Thank you very much for this, AJ.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Our sponsor for this episode is Earhart Automation Systems. Earhart builds and commissions turnkey solutions for their worldwide clients. With over 80 years of precision manufacturing, they understand the complex world of robotics, automated manufacturing, and project management, delivering world-class custom automation on time and on budget. Contact one of their sales engineers to see what Earhart can build for you. And they're at info@earhartautomation.com. And Earhart is spelled E-H-R-H-A-R-D-T. And I'd like to thank our partner A3, the Association for Advancing Automation. They're the leading automation trade association for robotics, vision and imaging, motion control and motors, and the industrial artificial intelligence technologies. Visit automate.org to learn more. And I'd like to thank our partner, Painted Robot. Painted Robot builds and integrates digital solutions. They're a web development firm that offers SEO and digital social marketing and can set up and connect CRM and other ERP tools to unify marketing, sales, and operations. You can find them at paintedrobot.com. And if you'd like to get in touch with us at the Robot Industry Podcast, you can find me, Jim Beretta, on LinkedIn. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there. Today's podcast was produced by Customer Attraction Industrial Marketing, and I'd like to thank my nephew Chris Gray for the music, Chris Colvin for audio production, my partner Janet, A3 Painted Robot, and our sponsor Earhart Automation Systems.